From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. On today's show, a UWM panel of experts hopes to tackle some of the big issues impacting Milwaukee's affordable housing crisis.
If we're only going to have affordable housing, depending on how you define that, in already high poverty areas where crime might be high as well, is that really the kind of housing that we want?
Later, Milwaukee and Steve Wallace explains why a quarter century ago he gave up his career to start a chocolate company in Ghana.
If I didn't start this when I did, which was at the age of 29, I was quite certain that I would regret it when I was 80. And the only thing I knew for sure was I didn't want to be 80 years old, look back and say, I missed the moment.
Milwaukee poet Vita Cross talks about her new collection, Bronzeville at Night, 1949.
And Wisconsin author Michael Perry explains his affinity for a 16th century French philosopher.
Lake Effect is next.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The annual Henry W. Meyer State of Milwaukee Summit at UWM begins tomorrow. This year, as a tribute to the 50th anniversary of the March on Milwaukee, the event is looking at the city's ongoing issues with affordable housing and the many ways they hope to solve the problem.
The summit will feature a panel of experts, including Rafael Ramos and Corey Schneider-Perugini. Rafael Ramos is the director of the Legal Action of Wisconsin's Eviction Defense Project, and Corey Schneider-Perugini is the senior administrator of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council's Inclusive Communities Program.
Schneider-Perugini and Ramos sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the summit and the impact of Milwaukee's affordable housing issues.
There's two different ways to think about affordable housing. One way is to think about the housing and urban development definition, which is housing is affordable if you're only paying 30% or less of your income for that housing. But there's also the subsidized kinds of housing, things like public housing, things like rent assistance or low-income housing tax credits that also can be considered affordable housing. So there's two different ways to think about it.
You know, from the perspective of our project where we're dealing with people who are facing eviction, I think there's a sort of real-world definition of affordable housing too. There's housing that people can afford where they're paying a certain amount for it. But one thing that I think should be kind of included in definitions is the concept that the housing has to be affordable, but it also has to be decent in some way. And that differs from the actual definitions that agencies use. But I think that concept is an important one and something that really shouldn't be lost when looking at what is affordable housing for people in the city.
So when we're talking about the affordable housing crisis in Milwaukee, are we talking about a lack of homes that people can afford or a lack of homes that, as you said, are good, are livable homes?
I think it's really a combination of both things. I mean, if you look at affordable housing, some of the programs that are in place, public housing, Section 8 housing assistance, the wait lists for those programs are closed. So people are having trouble accessing those programs and accessing that sort of assistance. So you have that first threshold issue of people actually getting this affordable housing with assistance from the government and other agencies. And then coupled with that, finding housing that is in decent condition without problems that make it difficult to live. When you look at those sorts of housing units, because they're in worse condition, they are inherently cheaper, which makes them more affordable. But it's a sword that cuts both ways.
And I think part of the affordable housing crisis is also the location of the housing that exists. And if we're only going to have affordable housing, depending on how you define that, in already high poverty areas where crime might be high as well, is that really the kind of housing that we want? If some of the ideas behind affordable housing is to provide stable housing in a safe neighborhood with the ideal goal of allowing people to escape generational poverty, then perhaps we need to be thinking about some non-traditional neighborhoods where that housing is located. Perhaps looking at communities where the job growth is taking place at a higher rate than Central City Milwaukee. So I think location is equally important in that equation.
Well, and I'm assuming that access to transportation also kind of plays into this.
Yeah, absolutely. Housing and transportation. There's a spatial mismatch between, say, Waukesha County and Central City Milwaukee, where a majority of the job growth over the last couple decades has been in Waukesha County, but black male joblessness in Milwaukee is, you know, upwards of 50%. And so how do you connect those two populations? How do you connect that labor force with those jobs? And one way is housing and the other way is transportation. So, yeah, they go hand in hand.
So what do the numbers look like when we're looking at specifically the housing crisis? How many people are without homes just in general or without an affordable home, a good affordable home?
Well, I can speak to that from the perspective of evictions, which is the area where I work. And when you look at the type of people who are being evicted, very often one of the reasons that they're being evicted is for inability to pay, failure to pay. And this isn't true in every case, obviously, but just in terms of number of evictions that have been filed, in 2016, there were over 13,000 evictions filed in the city, many of which are related to issues associated with failure to pay. Now, sometimes, a lot of times, you see failure to pay stemming from a conditions issue where someone says, this place isn't worth that much because the furnace doesn't work, so I won't pay for it. But that is, you know, the number that you're looking at. And that number has gone up. Basically, over the course of the last 5 years, the curve is going up. So in terms of that sort of lens, there's a clear issue in terms of people having access to housing that they can afford and is worth paying for.
In addition to that, to try to quantify the need for affordable housing, I know that nationwide, and I'm sure Milwaukee's not a whole lot different, that for every one rent assistance voucher, there are four people who need that voucher, who qualify, who have a low enough income that qualify and need that for housing stability. And so I would say if Milwaukee County has roughly 10,000 vouchers, the need is 40,000 households. Now, that's probably undercounting what the actual need is, but you can look at numbers and figure out what housing cost burdens are by population. That's one way to quantify what the need is, and housing burden would be if you pay between 30% or more of your income. And then a severe housing cost burden would be 50% or more of your income on housing.
Now, Corey, you work for Milwaukee's Fair Housing Council. What does the Fair Housing Council do for the city?
We work statewide, and we worked in Milwaukee and Waukesha County and Ozaukee and Washington counties. But essentially what we do is we enforce fair housing laws, housing discrimination laws at the federal, state, and local levels. Basically, you can't discriminate against people in housing based on race, color, ethnicity, religion, age, gender, sexual orientation, etc. So we enforce those laws. We take complaints from people who feel they were discriminated against. And we try to make sure people are aware of what their rights are. My job is a little different in that I'm the policy person at the organization. I look at some of the institutional and systemic barriers that keep our region segregated. And so just looking at things that seem very innocuous on their face, like municipal zoning, and think about the ways in which that kind of zoning is keeping us segregated.
Raphael, you work with Legal Action of Wisconsin, and more specifically, the Eviction Defense Project. How do both of those help improve this crisis, or maybe more specifically, address the crisis?
Yeah, so the Eviction Defense Project was a new initiative that was created by Legal Action of Wisconsin after we got a grant from Legal Services Corporation at the beginning of this year. So since January, we've been operating in the courthouse to provide free legal assistance to low-income tenants who are being evicted. So in my mind, the issue of eviction is tied very closely with the issue of affordable housing, because we've talked about people having access to affordable, decent housing. And one of the things that people have seen in, you know, for example, Matthew Desmond published this book, Evicted, that came out last year. And one of the things they showed was that a lot of renters are paying up to 70-80% of their income towards rent, which makes it difficult for them to live off and leading to evictions. So the issue, as I see it, is that the lack of affordable housing puts people in a position where they find themselves being evicted and really starting down a downward spiral of more and more difficult time finding housing, basically just because of the eviction record that's created. Once a person has that court filing against them, they have a hard time finding housing with reputable landlords, so they're forced to go to slumlords, places that are just in more poor condition, which makes it more likely that issues associated with conditions will come up, leading to non-payment, leading to another eviction, and really putting people in a real downward spiral where they have a hard time getting out and finding, again, a nice, affordable, decent place to live.
So you're both going to be on this affordable housing crisis panel over at UWM. What kind of topics are you hoping to tackle in that panel?
I think one of the main points that I'm hoping to address is this idea of the geography of opportunity, that where you live will play a role in your life outcomes, particularly where you grow up, where your life is formed. And we're looking at a lot of research that's been becoming richer and richer as the decades go about people who make a move from a high poverty to a low poverty community and the kinds of impacts that can have, impacts on health, on obesity and diabetes, on mental health, stress in particular, impacts on future graduation rates for kids, on having a higher income after you're employed, on less teenage pregnancy. So the impacts, I think, can be pretty huge. And I would like to talk about the solutions on how we can start to look at location and segregation and geography as part of the solution, but in addition to just looking at housing stability on its face, we need to kind of go the next step past that.
I mean, I think Corey's on track with a lot of the things she's talking about. I mean, one thing that you hear more and more recently is the concept of housing first, how important housing is for just the stability of families, households, not just in terms of work, but education for kids, for health. So I hope that that's a concept that is addressed in this coming panel. You know, one thing I also hope is talked about is the idea that a lot of low-income people in the city are living on a razor's edge, where if you have a cold and you miss work for a few days, for a week, all of a sudden you can't make rent and you're evicted. And one thing that often happens is if you're evicted, you lose your eligibility for some of these public housing programs that provide affordable housing. And, you know, when people are living in a situation where you're paying 80% of your income to rent and you don't have truly affordable housing, you know, there's not that much you can do. And I oftentimes hear people say, well, some people are just choosing not to pay rent. And that's just simply not true. It's because there's a real lack of affordable housing that people can afford and that is worth paying for.
Rafael Ramos is the director of the Legal Action of Wisconsin's Eviction Defense Project. Corey Schneider-Perugini is the senior administrator of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council's Inclusive Communities Program.
Both Ramos and Schneider-Perugini will be part of a panel on Milwaukee's fair housing crisis tomorrow evening at the UWM Student Union. There's more information on the event at wuwm.com.
Coming up next, Milwaukee entrepreneur Steve Wallace shares the origin story of his chocolate company based in Ghana. That is when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Just over a quarter century ago, Milwaukee native Steve Wallace started a chocolate company. It's not one of those huge players on the scene, nor is it a small boutique that makes truffles. Its greatest significance is that it makes chocolate bars in the African nation of Ghana, where cocoa beans are grown. And practically no one else has ever done that.
The 26-year journey has not always been easy or straightforward, and in fact started with a journey Wallace took to Ghana as a high schooler. He chronicles that first journey and the path that led to the creation of his company, Omanhini, in a new memoir called Obruni and the Chocolate Factory. Steve Wallace explained to Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why the time was right to look back.
I think it was a time of reflection after 26 years, and I thought about the journey I had gone on, and people were asking about it. And I think on some sort of deep psychological level, there were things I needed to get off my chest and things that I wanted to talk about. And I felt very privileged that I'd been on this journey. I was part of Ghana back when it was under military dictatorships. And now Ghana is one of the longest lasting and most stable democracies on the African continent. So I was sort of an unwilling eyewitness to this emergence from what they call the lost decades of coup after coup in Ghana.
Right, this is the time between the end of colonial rule and the beginning of democracy.
Right. And I found myself giving a speech at a university. And one of the lines I always have is, this is a long company story. This is not a fast company. We live in a fast company world. This is a story of a company that has grown over time. And I wanted to discuss the pleasures of doing a sort of a slow company. And I quipped that I thought this would make a better book or a screenplay than a company on some days because of the frustrations of trying to get all this off the ground.
Enjoying chocolate almost sounds like a metaphor for this. The idea of this being a slow company and, you know, wanting to enjoy chocolate over time rather than just wolfing it down.
Right. It's a slow, wonderful indulgence. And I looked at it that way for all the times that I thought there was some frustrations and I wish we had been growing faster and larger, quicker. There were just some wonderful moments on the journey that I wanted to share. And it was like really enjoying a fine piece of chocolate.
We have spoken about the company in the past, but honestly, I don't remember how far we went back in its story or your story. Your own connection to Ghana goes all the way back to high school.
To 1978. I was a high school exchange student. I grew up in Milwaukee and in the neighborhood of Whitefish Bay, and I won this scholarship on the AFS program, and they sent me to a little town called Sunyani, Ghana. And there I had my host father, his three wives, and his 21 children. So I took my place as child number 22, soon to be 23 because one of the wives was pregnant. And for me, it was a transformational experience. And I spent the really rest of my life looking for an excuse to go back.
But for as positive as an experience as it was, you were still an outsider. You were, this is where the term Obruni from the title of the book comes in.
Obruni, that's correct. So Obruni is the Chui language word, and Chui is maybe the largest spoken of the indigenous languages in Ghana, and it's spoken by the Akan people or the Asantes or the Ashantes, often called. And it means white person. And it comes from the story was everyone has a day name. So you might be Kofi or Kwame. And Kwesi was the name of for Sunday. And the story goes that the first white person came to Ghana on a Sunday. So all white people are called Kwesi Obrunis, literally white person who came on a Sunday. And so from then on, every white person there is named Kwesi or Kwesi Bruni, and that's what I was called.
You also got off to kind of an auspicious start when you got off the plane by inadvertently doing something that made you a little notorious, right?
Well, it was. And part of the reason I love going back to Ghana is all the years I've been going, and it's probably now close to 100 trips, I learned something new absolutely every time. And so I had this lingering mystery that had gone on over 30 years. And I mentioned it to a Ghanaian just about 2 years ago when he solved it. So I got off the plane in 1978. There were only three of us that were exchange students to Ghana. So I was two young women and myself. Got off the plane. It was really hot. And I took my windbreaker off. And I stood on the stairway that they had wheeled up to the plane. And I tied my windbreaker around my waist. And a woman who was in charge of the program grabbed my waist. She had a clipboard. She was angry. She ripped my coat off, and she wagged her finger at me, and she was furious. And this was my first 5 seconds in Ghana, and I had no idea what I had done. And all these years had sort of lingered, like there must have been something. And not too long ago, about 2 years ago, I mentioned this to a friend of mine who's Ghanaian. And he said, stand up and tell me what you did again. And I stood up, and I mimed putting my coat around my waist and tightening. And he said, oh, Stephen, that's too funny. He said, what you're doing is girding your loins. It's as if you were a warrior and you had the old traditional robes and you were readjusting them. And it means you're itching for a fight. So what I did in my first 5 seconds in Ghana as a 16-year-old back in 1978 was get off the plane, and I told the whole country I was itching for a fight. And at that moment, the one large newspaper happened to take a picture of us, and that was on the front page of the Ghanaian Times a day later, me telling all of Ghana that I was itching for a fight.
So flash forward 15 years or so, you had become a lawyer, then you'd gone to work for the family garment business. Realizing that Ghana had gotten under your skin those years before, when did that feeling go from just being a feeling to being this idea that you were going to start a chocolate company in a place where no chocolate manufacturing was going on?
I think it's in a moment of clarity, one of the few moments of clarity we all may get in a life. If I didn't start this when I did, which was at the age of 29, I was quite certain that I would regret it when I was 80. And the only thing I knew for sure was I didn't want to be 80 years old, look back and say, I missed the moment. And I loved Ghana. There was something so intriguing and compelling about it that I wanted to go back. I wanted to go back with some purpose.
With Ghana, but you were not theretofore a chocolate maker or a chocolate expert.
No, no. So when I looked at Ghana and I thought, how do I get this back in my life? And for me, it was like that wonderful book that's on the bookshelf and you keep going back every year or two to reread it. How do I get back to Ghana? And I looked at Ghana and they had really four main raw materials that I could sort of play with. One was, it used to be the Gold Coast. So there was gold, diamonds, bauxite, which is the mineral they make aluminum out of, and cocoa. So gold and diamonds were part of huge cartels. The aluminum business took billions of dollars in technical skills far beyond what I had. And then there was cocoa. And Ghana reputedly grows the finest cocoa beans in the world. They'll trade at a premium on the cocoa exchanges. And I grew up in a family of people who love to cook. So for me, I was comfortable in the kitchen. I looked at cocoa as one of the only four raw materials that I maybe could play with. So for me, it wasn't so much about chocolate. But cocoa became the vehicle that brought me back to Ghana.
Why, to that point, was there no decent chocolate that was coming out of Ghana?
Well, I think it is probably goes back to the colonial legacy, which was various going back to the Danes, the Portuguese, the British, and the French were all in West Africa, and they were there to extract things from the earth, whether it was the diamonds, the bauxite, the gold, or even the cocoa. And there was no even pause to consider processing them or adding value there. So they'd take the diamonds back to the Netherlands, for example, or Belgium. They'd do the diamond cutting there. They'd do the processing offshore. So there was never skills. And for generations, Ghana had just been a place that pulled things from the earth, gave them to someone. There was a ready market. They never had to market it. They never had to articulate a value proposition for why you should buy our gold or our cocoa or our bauxite. It just, there were off takers. And as long as the economic sort of arbitrage was in their favor, they had buyers. And I think just historically, Ghana never had this tradition of adding value. And that was seemed regrettable to me.
Well, and at the time you were starting this company, one of the issues was government ownership of processing plants.
Right. So Ghana is a country that had a vertically integrated cocoa industry. So the government of Ghana had an agronomy station which produced all the seed stock that all the farmers had to use. And the only private piece of this were the cocoa farmers. So you had 750,000 individual cocoa farms, largely owned by women because it's a matrilineal society. So these woman family-owned cocoa farms, they'd grow the cocoa, and the government had a monopoly that would buy every single bean back from the farmers at a guaranteed price. So if on January 1, they went to you and said it'll be $1,000 a metric ton, and at the end of the year the world price was $500, you as a cocoa farmer got the $1,000, and the government would go into debt as a consequence. If the world price went to $3,000, for example, you would get a bonus. You'd get most of that back. The government would keep a little bit, but you'd get your base floor price, plus you'd get a bonus. So it was a nice system. And then another government monopoly would take those beans, they'd aggregate them, and then they'd take them to the London and the New York markets and sell them. And the theory was, as I understand it, that the government didn't want some of the largest multinational cocoa processors negotiating with individual cocoa farmers who had, you know, probably inferior market knowledge, or at least these big multinationals would have superior market knowledge and could out-negotiate these farmers. So the government set up this vertical cocoa monopoly really to keep outsiders out. And I was an outsider and I had to find my way in.
What would you hope that someone reading this story today gets out of it? Is there a lesson about history that is also applicable to what people might be dealing with as they think about or go about the business of starting business today?
Yes, I think one of the motivations for writing the book was I wanted to talk about globalism in a far richer and a far more nuanced sense. And I think right now, globalism has become shorthand for economic exploitation, both abroad as we search for ever cheaper labor at the expense of domestic U.S. jobs. And I think that sort of that truncating of the conversation is doesn't do us any favors, because I think writ large and over the long term, international trade creates wealth. Economists, academics would support that. And so how do we begin in this country to articulate the merits of globalism? How can it be done right? How can it actually create value and not just take jobs from one country and give them to another? So I looked at this as a way of what could Wisconsin do? You know, what we have this wonderful packaging industry and papermaking industry. You can go back to the German immigration who brought this printing technology. And one of the printers I use still has printing presses from, I think, the 1930s or 40s that are beautifully maintained, these old German machines. And so, you know, we need to print really beautiful labels. We have to have beautiful packaging to compete worldwide. So I tried to do what we could do best here in Wisconsin, which was recipe development, the trade craft, the legal work, the packaging. But we can't grow cocoa here in Wisconsin, and we never will be able to just due to the climate. So what is it that Ghana could do? What machinery we could we get in Wisconsin and take to Ghana? And that's what I wanted to explain in this book and see if we could maybe be a prototype or an archetype for how globalism actually creates wealth and doesn't destroy it.
Steve Wallace is the founder and president of the Milwaukee and Ghana-based Omanhini Chocolate Company. His new book is called Obruni and the Chocolate Factory, an unlikely story of globalization and Ghana's first gourmet chocolate bar. And I'll talk about it next Tuesday at Basel Book Company. Wallace spoke with LakeFX's Mitch Teich.
Coming up next, another Milwaukee writer has an appearance at Boswell later this week. We'll talk with poet Vita Cross when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Vita Cross teaches English literature and creative writing at Milwaukee Area Technical College. But the Chicago native practices what she teaches at MATC and has just published her first book of poetry.
Bronzeville at Night, 1949, is Cross's exploration of the Chicago neighborhood where her grandparents moved to from Mississippi and where she grew up as a third-generation resident. Cross also finds inspiration in the paintings of Archibald J. Motley and the poetry of Langston Hughes. She'll be giving a reading and talk this Saturday at Boswell Book Company, but she joins us here first. Vita, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I love the poetry in your new collection, Bronzeville, 1949. Because you have the book in front of you.
Bronzeville at Night, 1949. At night.
In this collection, there are homages to a number of different poets that I love, but Langston Hughes in particular, one of my favorite American poets. And there are some just beautiful, if I didn't know better, I would say they were his poems.
They're not.
No, they're not.
I don't want him to come back and say they are. No, they're not. One piece comes from some research that he did in the Chicago area, and it's actually a found poem from a flyer that was posted for a church event. But some of them have his rhythms. And when I was doing research on Langston Hughes and I needed more poems for the book, there were a few poems, and I think I took out one and left in two. There were a few poems that I did just to swing them in his direction. And also because I think knowingly or unknowingly, I want to say subconsciously, when I was a college student, I would write like that. So I wanted to go back to that style consciously.
So what is the style? Is it a rhythmic style?
It's a rhythmic style, almost like a swing style of a hip cat, not hip hop, but a hip cat type of style. And very Langston Hughes, very jazz, Cab Calloway from back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. So I wanted to go back to that.
Had you been reading that stuff when you were a kid, or did you come to that as an adult?
Since I was a kid. I just did a reading for a poet who's no longer with us, named Fenton Johnson. And I was asked to do it before I really had any knowledge of Fenton Johnson, so I thought. And then as his poems were sent to me, I realized that I had been reading his work since I was a kid. And I'm not sure if this is true for every family, but I think it's true for many African-American families who are probably my age or older. There were anthologies, Negro anthologies, Black poetry anthologies, that we had on the shelves in my home, and I would just read them and enjoy them. And so I have been reading Langston Hughes since I can remember. Also, when I was in grammar school, I really did love rifling through the library. And I don't know if they still have libraries in many schools or if you have library time. I know that in some schools that I've been in, they have eliminated library time. But I love rifling through the library. And I would zero in on African-American history, African-American poets, Phyllis Wheatley, Langston Hughes. I'm just a big fan.
Me too. And even though I'm not African-American, there was something about the language and something about the rhythm of it. My mother was the one who introduced me to it, and she had some of those collections. I remember one called The Negro Caravan and some original, first editions of Langston Hughes' poetry. And there was something about the immediacy of the language, and even though it was not my experience, it resonated with me somehow, and it always has. It always has. It's beautiful. Beautiful construction and rhythm and language.
Right.
And so much of what was coming out of the Harlem Renaissance, it's so American.
Right. Right. And it also mirrors Carl Sandburg and people from that time period who are just coming down to a little bit more of a grassroots exposure, exposing what's happening with real people.
And taking poetry in a completely, well, maybe not completely different direction, but taking it in new directions.
Yes.
And not being married to the old ways of structuring
right. Language.
Right. Is there one that you would like to share with us that maybe kind of harkens back to that?
I rarely read these poems that harken back to that. So let me find them. I don't think I've ever read Boogie Woogie in Bronzeville. I'll read that one. I've never read that aloud.
Well, we're honored. We're honored that you want to do it here.
It's so interesting how a conversation will go in a direction. I didn't know we would be talking about this particular poem. No one's ever really asked me about Langston Hughes or zeroed in on Langston Hughes in the book. So I'll gladly read Boogie Woogie in Bronzeville after Langston Hughes. One. Hey, ain't you heard? The cops went bop, pop, a rebop over what's his name's head. Beating out, till he almost dead. Two, dance with me, my sweet brown thing. Dance with me to see what morning bring. Three, and while you listen to the music play, make a drum beat, make my Chicago heart beat. Let's boogie woogie in Bronzeville. Easy how you rock my soul. Give me that easy roll. Four. See that? See that girl with her long pigtails? She boogie woogie till the cops take her to jail. See that lady with her red dress? She boogie woogie till it's all a mess. See that man in his suit? He boogie-woogie, like me and you.
Peter Cross, thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful stuff. Now, I know you grew up in Chicago. Did you grow up in Bronzeville?
No, I did not. I grew up primarily on the South Side, and later I moved to the Bronzeville area. My grandparents, when they came from Mississippi, moved to Bronzeville, and some of the poems are also based on some of their experiences in Chicago. They moved to 35th Street. What is now Lake Meadows is where their home was. They had a gravestone on 35th, just right off of what is now King Drive. And I just felt compelled to write the poems. I think I came up with the title once I was done with 80% of it, or maybe 50%. But once I knew that I was going to set it in the past, I knew it was going to be about Bronzeville. And I'll tell you, I know that once I wrote the Bronzeville poem, which was early on, it was probably one of the first 10 poems that I wrote, I knew that this book would be called Bronzeville because I was basing the poems off of Archibald J. Motley's artwork. And his artwork is set in Bronzeville. So it was a combination of things, not just me living there and my grandparents living there, but it just all came home. A set of random events or random thoughts that came together.
I'm hoping you will share another poem with us, and it's completely poet's choice. So whatever you feel.
I'll read the title poem. It's called Bronzeville at Night. And at this time, I'll talk about a little bit about Archibald J. Motley. This poem is based on the little girl at the very, very far end of this painting. And she's sitting on the stoop. And one of the parts about this book that I think goes unnoticed is that there are children in the book and there are children in the painting. And what I noticed quite often when I was watching movies about jazz, and so often when you're talking about blues, you're also talking about jazz, or maybe people think you're talking about jazz as well. But so often you have children in the atmosphere, in the outdoor scenes, in the nightclub scenes, and you have artists, singers, musicians who will say, I started playing at a nightclub when I was 12, or I would go and listen. And so I know that at some point I always felt that children were a part of the community. And so Bronzeville at Night is from the young girl's perspective. And it too is in three parts. One, front yard. In city summers, we wait for the breeze from trains, rain, or slam doors. Summer turns war, sheer curtains are drawn, tulips parade. Touch the rose, the pain will repeat itself, repeat the healing. Showing off, one bud, rounding pink petals, turned from Sunday dresses. Flower beds greeted me, furnished rooms overwhelmed me. I lie flowered to rest. 2, State Street. Spotting the woman's round rear in the window, Jack's Chicken Shack, the blue night's glow, the full street, a couple of red dresses and 2 stoplights, Mr. Archibald J. Motley stood on the corner of 35th Street. The fat man dropped his head. I snuck onto the front stoop. Mr. Motley sketched dark lines. The fat man whistled the tune of head snapping, shoe heels tapping, bent knees flapping. I sat still, hoping Mr. Mott would sketch me too. 3, juke joint. Night calls men away, night answers. The two meet, shaking up the joint. Bodies throb, jumping the rip, strip, whip of music. If you believe death, the crow has fallen. Relieved of our city life.
Peter Cross, I want to thank you so much for reading some poems today and talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Vita Cross teaches English literature at MATC. Her debut collection of poetry is called Bronzeville at Night, 1949. She'll read from it this Saturday at Boswell Book Company, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
What does reading a 16th century French philosopher have in common with the chickens in Wisconsin writer Michael Perry's coop? Well, we'll find out when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. For a long time, the Montaigne most mentioned on public radio has been former Morning Edition host Renee Montaigne. This is not an interview about Renee Montaigne. It is instead an interview about the 16th century French philosopher Michel de Montaigne.
And even then, it's not so much an interview about the philosopher, but rather a conversation with Wisconsin writer Michael Perry about how he's learned more about himself through reading the words of a long-departed nobleman. Perry's new book is called Montaigne in Barn Boots, and he explained to Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke where it all started.
It was an accident of urology. And what happened is I had a kidney stone a while back, and like a lot of self-employed folks, I had really bad health insurance. And I knew I was going to have to pay for the whole trip to the ER and the meds and all that out of my own pocket. So as I was lying on the gurney in the ER, I thought, well, I should try and write an essay about this and maybe I can sell it to a magazine. And indeed, I pitched it from the ER and got the go-ahead. After that, when I actually had to settle down and write the piece, and I did it for Men's Health magazine, they actually wanted some actionable information. I started reading medical journal pieces about kidney stones. And this guy Montaigne kept popping up. He was this 16th century philosopher slash nobleman. And they kept citing him, I think, you know, docs and researchers who write pieces like that, they're always looking for a way to make their research interesting. And so they would put a little something in there about this guy, Montaigne, who had written about having kidney stones in the 1500s. So honestly, it's embarrassing to admit that's how I discovered him, because as a writer, I should have been able to tell you, well, some say he invented the essay. But no, I came to him through kidney stones. But then, of course, I veered off into reading his other stuff and found it fascinating and approachable and relatable. And it became a hobby of mine to read him.
So you share this great image, the metaphor of pouring his essays through a colander and scraping out what's left. And, you know, I think a lot of us imagine like the process of reading philosophy is going to a dimly lit library, a drafty room with the faces of doer people staring down at you. But it appears you prefer your Montaigne in kind of drips and drabs when you can take them.
Yeah, two things about that. Rather than going to a dark place, I have read a lot of Montaigne on a deer stand on my iPhone, because that's what I got with me. And you pull up an app and read some Montaigne. And then the other thing, I have a chapter about how I do read Montaigne, and I talk about going out to feed the chickens and how they're forever zigzagging here and there. You know, you throw the feed out and they're like, oh, there it is. And they get started one place and then they see another chicken eating. They're like, oh, no, the good stuff's over there. And they whip over there. And then they see something over by a thistle and they go over there. And so in a sense, yes, that's how I've picked up on Montaigne through tweets, through blogs, through comment sections, through books, through websites, everything. It's just sort of take it as it comes and very tangential. And then I also equate, there's always the chicken who grabs the biggest piece of gristle and is real piggy about it, but then suddenly discovers she can't swallow it. And so she just stands there blinking for 2 hours, but refusing to let go. And that often happens to me when I'm reading Montaigne.
Well, it's interesting because just a few minutes ago, I did an interview with a group of people for whom philosophy was the entree for them to start reading more slowly. And that seems to maybe mesh with how you have to kind of be able to work with Montaigne.
Right. I have a whole chapter in the book about absent-mindedness, because Montaigne wrote a lot about being absent-minded. I've always felt bad as a writer in the fact that I have a terrible retention. If I can read a novel and love it and enjoy it and immerse myself in it, but I have a terrible time keeping track of plots. And if someone asks me 20 minutes after I finish it about certain characters, I sometimes can't remember them. And that's always bothered me. But Montaigne himself said, if I'm a man of much reading, I am also a man of very little retention. And I remember reading that and going, oh, well, if it was okay for him, it's okay for me. But that then feeds into the absent-mindedness chapter, where I talk about I have to go back and read and reread in order to really absorb something. And fortunately, Montaigne's the kind of writer that you can revisit him and still find him engaging and interesting.
You write a lot about this idea of intersectionality, and not even just in the chapter on intersectionality, but that's kind of where this notion of being able to exist in multiple worlds, which is sort of what Montaigne kind of gets into as well.
Yeah, and there's another example. I use the term intersectionality, but I also take a moment to explain to folks that, look, this is a very specific academic term. It has very specific meaning. You need to understand that I'm already wandering off the yard once I start using it. And that's an issue of respect to the academics who have worked on this concept. On the other hand, I am also trying to speak to a group of folks who are at the Volunteer Fire Department meeting. And so I'm trying to work both places. And you know, I got an email the other day from someone who said, I had to look up the word intersectionality. Well, the mission accomplished then. In that chapter, I think I start out by talking about the fact that it's a shame that Montaigne couldn't make it to the 2013 Augusta Bean and Bacon Day's Demolition Derby, because my daughters and I went. We had a great time. But 2 days previous to that, we went to the Shakespeare Festival, and it was my younger daughter's first exposure to the Bard. And there's this idea that, at least that I feel so fortunate, that I'm happy to be at the Shakespeare Festival. I'm happy to be at the Demolition Derby. It's difficult to discuss in that you don't want to come off as saying, look, I'm such a great guy. No, no. What I try to tell my daughters, it's not about you being a great guy, that you are a great person, that you're working both ends of the cultural spectrum. It's the fact that you've actually expanded your opportunities for joy. And I have a whole thing in there about me having to look at myself in the mirror constantly and take myself down a peg and reassess. And Montaigne was very, very good at that. Yeah. And he'd also, I mean, he'd write about anything. He wrote about sex and thumbs and the sexual danger of coaches, the kind that are pulled by horses, that is. But he would take on anything.
Well, and you take on anything. And if memory serves, I think I have read nearly everything that you have published. I don't remember quite as much discussion of sex in any of your previous efforts. In fairness, it's mostly driven by the writings of Montaigne, however.
Yes. Everything in here is predicated on something that Montaigne wrote. And I thought, this is an unfortunate phrase, but I thought long and hard about doing this. And the reason I did it is not that prurient, and I really couldn't keep up with the prevalent prurience if I wanted to. But it's pretty blunt, and I just feel like there were some things I wish I'd have known earlier in life. And even later in life, there were things I wish that I'd have known more people understood. And so writing about – if you're going to write about life, you got to write about sex. And so it is in there. And as I said, it's not – there's nothing too personal or
and Montaigne had some interesting views of sex and marriage, most notably what he saw the value of extramarital
occurrences. Yeah, his views, they're a mix of progressive and deeply problematic. And I think, as I have said, as the excuse and epithet has it, he is a man of his times, and that phrase is a really tricky phrase. But yeah, he, on the one hand, he was progressive in the sense that he felt that women had a right to have a rich sex life and that they were interested in. But on the other hand, he said things like, well, I believe in having a mistress because I do depraved things with her. I would never do those things with my wife because she's a gallant and good woman. I'm going, well, I don't know how that discussion would go at your kitchen table.
Which is, again, speaks to how, you know, it's one thing to read a 16th century French philosopher. It's another thing to take everything that a 16th century French philosopher says as literally, relevant in the 21st century.
Well, that's another thing I hit on in the book. When I first started reading Montaigne, what happened to me happens to a lot of people, including Sarah Bakewell, an English woman who wrote a wonderful book about Montaigne a couple of years ago. You start out by going, oh, my gosh, that's me. Oh, that's me. That's me. But as I wrote in the book, there's a danger in that. You also have to examine the areas where you don't agree and or where you maybe see something in him that reminds you of yourself, but it ain't in a good way. And so I try to do that as well.
I want to ask you one other area that was, maybe it surprised me that it showed up in here, and I found myself strangely interested in it. And that was you're trying to evaluate where you come down on the idea of aesthetics.
Yeah. That came as a surprise to me, too. But the paragraph that opens that chapter, I wrote it. It's about Prince and how Prince was an influence on me. Now, look at me. There's just a whole bunch of reasons why you would never guess that and why Prince probably wouldn't want you to guess
Not wearing a lot of purple, yeah. for starters.
But I wrote that, and then about a week later, he died. And I was caught off guard by how the day I heard he died, I was at my desk in rural Fall Creek, Wisconsin, and I felt really sad. And I felt like a certain energy had disappeared from the world that you just always knew that he was at least there making things. And suddenly it was gone. And I was clearly not the only one feeling that way. But that got me just to thinking about how he, you know, despite our dissimilarities, he expanded my idea of masculinity. He expanded my idea of creativity, and he expanded my idea of the Midwest. Now, in the book, I said he expanded it a bit more than was sustainable for me, but he got me started. And then that got me to thinking about, I've always been embarrassed by aesthetics. I care about how things look and sound and feel. I talk about the word aesthetics itself. I love it when it's spelled A-E instead of just E, because there's something about the meshed AE that drops my blood pressure about 5 points. And that's silly, but it's true. And when you come from where I do, which is blue-collar background, farmers, loggers, and whatnot, you're kind of embarrassed to admit that you care how your coffee cup looks and that the shape of my coffee cup and the feel of the brush steel affects the way that I taste the coffee. Not the kind of thing that you talk about down to feed mill generally. Although, they care how their pickup trucks look. Well, that's aesthetics. And so, yeah, I dove off into aesthetics, and there was also a lot of fun to be had because Montaigne is talking about, he's like, yeah, there's these people that are sticking rods through their noses and in their ears. I'm like, yeah, we call that the mall. Yeah, but yeah. But I said something to the effect that ultimately I like to believe that aesthetics are a form of grace and that grace precipitates grace or enlarges grace or something like that. So I hope maybe.
Well, and in terms of quoting, I think someone else makes the point that you quote that really, when it all comes down to it, the best book written about Montaigne was written by Montaigne.
Yeah, and what I say about that quote is you want to put that at the end of your Montaigne book.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's the truth. What you really want to do is you want to sit down and read the guy himself.
Mike Perry, always a great chance to catch up with you. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Wisconsin writer Michael Perry's latest book is called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. He spoke with Mitch Teich ahead of an appearance this evening at Books & Company in Oconomowoc. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Like Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It is 11 o'clock.